Welcome to this week's addendum for our series on Keith Davis. This is addendum 3, and I'm here with Amelia. Hey, Amelia.
Hi.
And with us today is Megan Kinney. She is a co-founder of Open Justice Baltimore, and some of the BPD will know her as the girl with the sign. Megan, can you explain that to me?
Yeah, so during the uprising after the death of Freddie Gray, I was one of the many protesters in the streets demanding justice for Freddie. And I held a sign that said, "Stop Killer Cops." And apparently that was a familiar sign to BPD. And they referred to me as the girl with the sign. Despite being 37 years old at the time, I was still referred to as a girl, but whatever. So, yeah, I've just been, I'm a resident of Baltimore City, have been for 10 years, and just felt compelled to get out in the streets for Freddie and for all victims of police brutality. And through all that activism and protesting, I learned of Keith and Kelly and Keith's story. And so I've been a part of Team Keith for almost 4 years now.
And can you tell me a bit about Open Justice Baltimore and how that came about?
Yeah, Open Justice Baltimore is a collective of data scientists or data-minded people, and we collect, or we sort of gather all this publicly available data into one place so that the public can be more informed about the information that's out there of people in power and people with badges and guns. And so we have one tool called Case Harvester that harvests all of the data from the Maryland Judiciary case search for Baltimore City and compiles it into one place where people can go and then access that data and look and do true data analysis. Because as of right now, the case search is very siloed. Yeah, siloed. Insane. And clunky. And you have to really scotch tape pieces together. And so this tool does that for you. And so you can look across time. You can look longitudinally at officers' behaviors, really, and judges' behaviors and prosecutors' behaviors. And another tool we have is BPD Watch, which is we just launched last week. It's an online roster of all of Baltimore police officers from two rosters that we got through MPIA requests. And so it allows the public to learn who is in our neighborhoods with badges and guns. And if BPD is so concerned about strengthening a peaceful relationship with the public, they shouldn't have a problem with us knowing who they are. So
do they have a problem with that, with the news site?
The former president of FOP, Victor Gerhardt, certainly does. But he's, well, I won't go into that, but no, they shouldn't, but some do, because, you know, the immediate jump is that it's an invasion of privacy. Well, all of this data is publicly available, and none of it is, you know, there's no resident information. Like, we don't put their addresses. We literally just put stuff that is publicly available that you either get through Open Baltimore or MPIA requests. So it's not private anyways. And their salaries, right? And so you can see, like, you can see their salaries over the years.
Their overtime.
Their overtime over the years. And it really just allows the public to know who's walking around with badges and guns and what, how much money we're spending on them, right? So you, one of the things that we eventually want to do is be able to find, collect, and then make accessible how much taxpayer money is spent on civil cases that the police are found responsible for. So, like, you know, if an officer has 10 civil suits against them and they lose them all, how much money is the public just given out for this one officer who has demonstrated uncivil behavior, really? And my guess is that it would be mind-blowing how much, you know, it could be like one officer could cost a city hundreds of thousands of dollars because they won't stop beating the shit out of people and they don't get fired. So, you know, we need to know that.
I mean, this is not a problem that's unique to Maryland in any way, but and especially how the MPIA works, even when records are supposedly available and open, and you can get them for a specific case, if you can get them for a specific case, being able to get all this data into one place in usable form is often impossible. And unless you know that exactly what you're looking for before you start, it's impossible to find things like trends or you know, a pattern of cases.
Exactly.
Just because the way they're set up is to respond sometimes just to like name cases.
Exactly. And one of the, you know, Open Justice Baltimore was really birthed out of Team Keith. It was during this third murder trial when the GTTF scandal was exposed. And a few of us on Team Keith, who are a little bit more data-minded, analytical nerd types, were trying to find if any of Keith's shooting officers had a documented history with any of the GTTF officers. And so what we ended up doing was going into case search and then searching it by individual officer and then downloading those CSV files into a master Excel spreadsheet, downloading all the GTTF officers, adding them to the master spreadsheet, and then doing, you know, Excel stuff to figure out how many cases they shared. And that's when we were like, there has to be a better way. Like, this is crazy. We got a man on the moon. We can pay our rent through our phones. Why can't we see any patterns of officers without having to make this, you know, scotch tape Excel spreadsheets together, you know? And so we were like, there's got to be a better way. And so we ended up linking up with this guy Dan, a friend of ours, who's a programmer, and he was already working on a tool to scrape it. And so that's really what it came from, is out of our work and our time with Keith and Kelly and Keith's case, and then GTTF popping off. And it was like, this, there's more to uncover here. And the data systems that are in place, whether intentional or not, don't allow that, or not accessible for the public. And so that didn't seem right. That didn't seem just. It's our data. It's us, you know? And so that's really where it came from. And we wanted to see, you know, one of the other things that we wanted to happen from these tools is to be able to follow a person from arrest all the way through to verdict and sentencing, if there's a sentence, and to see if there are patterns between arresting officers to assistant state's attorneys to judges, and see if there are patterns of, you know, if Officer X and Prosecutor Y and Judge Z had higher rates of guilty with high bails versus other combinations. And so we're not there yet, but that's what we're building to, is to be able to unveil what the data show us.
It's like Moneyball for criminal justice reform.
Yeah, exactly. And it's, it's utter madness to think that in a city like Baltimore with Johns Hopkins University, who's making drones the size of insects, that this isn't already there and already out, you know, available and built. But, you know, Johns Hopkins continues to prove that it's complicit in all of this as well. And I say that as an alum.
You know, there are millions of people who suffer from a very fairly common illness, and for years they have no idea what's going on. They just are dealing with symptoms like constipation, abdominal pain, bloating. And you know, you tell yourself, well, maybe something I ate, it's not so bad. I don't know, take a laxative, eat some more fiber, fix your exercise routine, and nothing helps. You know why? Probably because you have no idea that you are suffering like 13 million others with something called irritable bowel syndrome with constipation, or IBS-C. Instead of wasting more time and frustration and being in pain and misery, find out if maybe this is what you're suffering from. All you have to do to get more information about your symptoms and IBS-C is go to ohmygut.info/podcast. It's O as in O-H, mygut.info/podcast. And you can learn about all the different issues you're dealing with, constipation, abdominal pain, and bloating. And if you're ready, you can also find ways to talk to your doctor or access one online. So check it out. Stop suffering with it. Once again, that's mygut.info/podcast. mygut.info/podcast.
Well, in this episode, episode 3, we got more into the stories, or lack thereof, of the officers involved, both as witnesses and in the shooting itself, and more about how their stories, I guess, didn't add up.
Yeah, I would say that they didn't. I mean,
well, that's not surprising. That really isn't. Like, it's a high pressure situation. So, like, there, you'd expect a certain level of variance and confusion here. But
totally. Yes, exactly. I mean, witnessing accounts, they're genuine. You're never going to get completely perfect lining up. Then that's actually a sign of like serious coaching. But, you know, there were things like, you know, of the 4 out of the 5 witnessing officers that were actually interviewed on the day of the shooting were interviewed 5 hours afterwards. And they had certain things like this, certain sort of tentpole things that they could remember, quote unquote. You know, he had a gun. You know, he said this and he was handcuffed and then everybody called a medic. But when pressed for the actual details behind those things, that's when they started to veer very, very like just far away from each other. Yeah. And yet nobody pressed them on it. I mean, that's kind of one of the things I wanted the episode to show, is that like the interviews that the force investigation team, who was investigating the police involved shooting, the interviews they were doing with the witnessing officers, you know, it was almost sort of like they were doing what they had to do. They had to do these interviews, but they weren't doing any sort of real investigation because they weren't pressing them to really get behind what those discrepancies were about and trying to figure out, okay, you know, what's true, what's not, what did somebody maybe miss this part because they were standing somewhere else? Like, they didn't try and figure out at all why there were these discrepancies. And so what we're left with is a bunch of accounts that don't really add up and certainly don't explain what happened in that garage.
It seems like their goal is to get from like A to Z on the checklist, and they find the simplest way to do their job and get through it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, and Megan can speak to this too, but like this incident, and we've talked about this on the show and in previous addendums, but this shooting did not happen in a vacuum. And it happening so soon after the death of Freddie Gray, so soon after the uprising, there was a real scramble to put a lid on any potential negative publicity, any potential for there to be an additional uprise, like for people, the citizens, to get reinvigorated and back out on the streets, because this man who did not fire at officers, no matter what, you know, the charging documents will have you believe, that he was shot in the face, and they fired a lot of bullets into that garage, and that they really pretty effectively put a lid on it and stopped there from being any sort of real media attention or response from the community.
Yeah, I think BPD and the state's attorney's office are really giving a master class in public deception here. They really have created a narrative that the public believed right away. And it took Kelly to really challenge that. And slowly more people are coming around to understanding that the truth that we were presented was false. And they really did a good job at manipulating the truth and manipulating people's fears and manipulating the narrative so that you couldn't believe what the alternative was. It was easier to believe the police in the beginning because it seemed outrageous, and they just continued spinning that. And spinning it. And it's slowly unraveling now. But in the beginning, with, you know, the context of the city was, we were on the brink of a revolution. And I know that people scoff at that, but that really was true. And then it was quickly shut down because of the indictments of the officers, and people believed in Marilyn Mosby. I did. I voted for her. I voted for her in 2014 in the election against Bernstein. I really did. I believed that she was the voice that the city and the world needed. And it took me a while to really come to terms with the fact that that wasn't necessarily true. It took a long time. For me, looking back, it felt too long. But they did a really good job in manipulating public perception, and it continues, and they keep trying.
You know, it's worth noting too that, like, there are some really sort of big differences between the context in which Freddie was arrested and fatally injured and what happened with Keith. Like, Freddie was arrested on a public street with his neighbors had come outside. Friends were filming what was happening, which then immediately got uploaded online. Keith, when he was chased by police, ran into a dark garage, and the two witnesses, the civilians who were there, were sort of very quickly ushered down the block. And so that entire sort of shooting was contained, and nobody was there to actually see it besides those officers.
I mean, they're just lucky they didn't kill the who was the woman in the...
Yeah, Martina Washington. She got, one of the officers...
It flew by her head.
She said she heard the whiz of the bullet go by her ear. I mean, they were really out of control, but there was nobody filming it. I mean, I really think there's something to be said for the fact that, like, and we see this time and time again in cases like this, like, video is the defining difference in sort of what gets attention. And there was no video on this, and there were no real actual witnesses to the actual shooting. And so that allowed the police department to completely control the narrative. And, you know, what they wanted ideally was for Keith to die, and then they would be entirely in charge of the narrative. There would be no alternative. And they did not get their wish, but their response to that has been to find every way possible to sort of silence him by keeping him in prison. Honestly, like, that's what's happened.
Yeah. So, Amelia, given how the shooting went down, and you have all these officers who are responding not just to what they see from Keith, but to one another, do you think that, given the angles involved, they could have, like, seen Keith's phone and genuinely thought it was a gun?
Yes. I think, you know, I do think, first of all, I think that the two officers who were chasing the armed robber of the hack driver, like, I legitimately do think that they were chasing somebody. I think that they were much further behind. Like, I don't think that they were as close on the heels of that person as they would like us to believe. And so I think that that person very likely took a detour and got away midway through the sort of foot chase. And what they saw ahead of them was, you know, ahead of them, people had been sort of calling out, he has a gun. And so Keith is among a number of people who sort of, when you hear he has a gun, you just go, you just run. And I think those officers, because they never got a good look at the guy to begin with, thought Keith was the person that they were chasing. And then in the garage, look, the garage was incredibly dark. And the day outside was like one of those bright, kind of glary, like, days. And so I think looking in the garage, they very likely thought his phone was a gun. What's crazy is that the number of bullets they fired off, well over, I hesitate to say the number now because I'm sort of sifting through something, but, you know, well over 30 bullets, let's say. And that's an obscene amount of firing to be doing, first of all, into a dark space, enclosed space.
But also an obscene amount not to hit the target.
Well, right. Exactly. I mean, that's the thing. They kind of go back and forth. Like, sometimes it's so dark in there that they can't see things that it's convenient for them not to see. But then they all can see that he has a gun. But then they can't describe the gun. And, like, regardless, they didn't know whether there was anybody else in there. Like, they were really wilding out.
So if one officer fires, is it possible that others think that it's coming from inside and they just, like, start unleashing hell?
They heard ricochets. And I think the problem is... And I think the problem is at a certain point, though, there was a, you know, they would stop firing. And the fact of the matter is, at some point, these are trained officers. They should have recognized at some point, wait a second, there's no bullets flying past us. We're not seeing any bullets hitting our direction. you know, the sounds we're hearing, hey, maybe those are ricochets because we're firing into an enclosed space.
Now, did they have covers? Like, was there cover they could get behind? Or where were
they were on either side of, like, the bay doors. This is their account of what happened. Like, let's be clear that, like, again, we're sort of dependent on what they say happened, but there are things that I'm dubious about, and I know that all of us are kind of dubious about. But their story is that they were on either side of the sort of wide bay door that you could fit a full car to drive into. And then one of the officers, Sergeant Santiago, he had a bunker out. And so they were kind of using that. And but other than that, yeah, like it was a big wide open door. So let's say Keith had a gun and he was firing. Like, Keith could have very easily fired outside the door. Like, they would have seen bullets hitting the sergeant's car, the ground, like, unless, you know what I mean? There should have been a moment that kicked in where they were like, wait a second, maybe this guy actually isn't firing a gun.
Well, Diana Brown even said on the stand when asked, did she fire? And she said no. And I think the next question was, why not? And she said, because I couldn't see into the garage. So there were officers on the scene who chose not to shoot their guns.
Right.
And so, or not even have their guns ready. So it's a matter of four officers literally not being able to control themselves. And I understand that, like, this is a heightened situation. I'm not saying that people are going to go in being robots. What I'm saying is that a certain, you know, there were officers who didn't shoot. And so what's the difference between them and the ones who did?
Different training, background, years in the force.
Exactly. And so is there a way to know that ahead of time and to be able to sort of filter out people who behave in such a way?
And remind me, I know this is subject to debate. What were the shot totals from each, roughly?
Well, so the totals for each of them, according to the paperwork, and I say that with some hesitation because I have some, there's reasons to have sort of questions about the information that was sort of coming out of the department early on.
So with all those caveats, though, like, what's the rough official story?
Okay, so Santiago fired 14 times. Officer Eskins fired 12 times. And then both Israel Lopez and Catherine Philippou each fired 3 times. So the total number of shots fired, according to the police department, was 32.
And is there any sense of, like, when Eskin and Philippou were firing?
Yes. So Eskins, Philippou, and Santiago all arrived at the garage within the sort of same 5-second period, I'm going to say. And who fired first has been a sort of subject of debate, because according to the witness, Martina Washington, who felt the bullet go whizzing by her, she, by all accounts, is the first person to have heard a bullet like a shot. And she describes a female officer. So we assume it's Catherine Philippou. However, both Eskins and Santiago suggest it was Santiago who fired first. We haven't gotten in yet to sort of tell that the accounts coming from the actual firing officers. And I said this in the episode this week, but, you know, as much as it was confusing, the sort of different accounts from the witnessing officers, like, the list of discrepancies and just, like, head spinning accounts, once you introduce the firing officers, it's incredible. Like, it's really hard to understand what exactly happened and who did what when, and, you know, ultimately who kind of got this whole thing started. I would say that it seems that more than likely it was Catherine Philippou who fired off the first shot, if the witness is to be believed. And that would make sense based on kind of fitting with some other accounts, but I don't know. I mean, that's the problem with the fact that this was not investigated well, is that we're left with so many questions about what actually happened in that garage, because the investigators were not interested in finding out what happened in that garage. They were interested in justifying what happened in that garage.
And do we know how long the phone call was from Keith to Kelly?
Yeah, it was 1:07. Okay. It started at 9:57.
Yeah, I wish we had, I mean, just imagining the audio of that. I mean,
oh God.
30 shots is a ton of shots, but, like, that's a long time to stretch out that many shots.
Well, he had already been shot by then.
Okay, that was done.
So then he called Kelly, and it was while he was on the phone with Kelly, Like, we believe the shooting started, I'm pretty sure that the shooting probably started around 9:52. Like, I think Keith was, like, running around back of that garage, trying to, like, figure a way out, hiding behind the refrigerator, gets shot in the arm at some point, calls Kelly, and we hear, what Kelly heard was sort of the tail end of
the shooting.
I'm
sorry, but his reaction is, like, so natural, and also so, like, to call Kelly, like, he was so desperate, like, what's he gonna do? Like,
yeah.
But that, I mean, that's a testament to Kelly.
Yeah.
That's right. What he, and in his mind, it's like, what do I do? And of course, no one can do anything at that point, but that's what he thinks instantly to do.
Right. Because it's a testament to Kelly of that's what he needs. That's his anchor.
So yeah. My impression, though, was that at the end of that phone call was like when he was shot in the face.
In the face. Yeah.
So this is, we're at least minimum almost 2 minutes here for total shooting time.
Oh, yeah. And I think all the officers sort of, I think the minimum amount of time that the officers estimate, I think somebody estimated like 3 to 5 minutes at the minimum, and somebody else said something like 10 to 15.
Jesus. I mean, time does feel like it lasts forever, but if there's no way it's 10 to 15, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, I think it lasted probably I think it was probably around 5 to 7 minutes more likely. It's hard to say because I think if Keith got hit in the face around 9:58, and we know that around about 10 o'clock is when the medic was called. So, and I think we can kind of figure out the timing based on when, like, there was an anonymous call for a shooting at 9:55, so that we know that the shooting had started by then. And that person said that they heard 15 to 20 shots by 9:55. So I figure that it probably started around 9:52. That seems to kind of work with the timing, like what little sort of time stamps we do have to plug in. But yeah, so we think, I mean, and I think Kelly really firmly believes that the reason why the call dropped with Keith is because he got shot in the face and the phone dropped to the ground and that was that.
Yeah. I mean, that's just such a long time for shots to be going on and on and on. I mean, at that point, you'd almost think that you'd assume that everything in there was dead or audible. Well,
yeah. And we're also talking about, like, you know, at that point, there's, you know, 9 officers on scene, as far as we know. I think it's possible even more. And they really could have, I think they could have figured out a way to hold the situation. You know, they could have brought in SWAT. They didn't need to light up that garage. Like, they're, you know, I don't think that BPD training typically recommends that you, you know, fire off an entire magazine into a garage that has no way for somebody. You know, they could have barricaded him in and waited until you had, like, SWAT team or, like, negotiators or something. But that just did not happen. They went wild.
Yeah, there was something about that mindset and that energy or whatever that was happening that day for these 4 officers to just really go primal. And these 4 specific officers, because there were, Diana Brown didn't shoot at all. And she was in this, you know, apparently he ran in front of her car. So there was something that happened within the minds of these 4 officers for them to literally go primal and just not think. And
so I hesitate to say this because I don't want to, like, downplay just 3 shots, because that's definitely not what I mean. But it does seem like there's a very distinct difference here between the reactions of Eskin and...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that there's something, I think that, you know, to me, it's very interesting. Santiago is the sergeant, and he unloaded a whole magazine. And
the sergeant's going off, then why shouldn't everyone else?
Exactly. And what's interesting to me is that, so the sergeant fires off 14 rounds, and it sounds like that all happens, according to his account, which I'll be playing it next week, but all happens according to him, all kind of at once. And now, that's not what other officers say, which is why I'm saying that, like, these accounts get even, like, more veer away from each other the more they're introduced. But according to Santiago, he sort of emptied a round, he reloaded, and then never fired another bullet for the rest of the incident, which is bizarre. You know, like, that's interesting to me. Eskins, by everybody's sort of account, was just kind of firing continuously throughout. Lopez was late to arrive. Philippou was there from the very, very beginning and fired.
Possibly the very first one, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a lot in Philippou is kind of viewed by the other officers on scene. There's some quotes from them in their statements where, you know, she at points was standing sort of almost in like firing range, where, like, if he did have a gun, she would have been shot. Like, the way she wasn't taking cover behind anything. She's an interesting character, and she's the one who has since been has since left the department because she was under FBI investigation for running drugs in the Northwest and being sort of like security for a drug organization.
And man, if you're doing that, don't be firing a service weapon, like, exactly. Unless you like absolutely have to, like, have some chill.
But that says something, right? Is that she felt that she could. And so what does that say about the climate and the culture of BPD that a person with a badge and a gun can be running drugs, being security for drug rings, and shoot indiscriminately into a dark garage? She did it because she felt she could.
Right.
And that's really what I'd like to have the public really understand when this is all unveiled, is this is an organization that allows for this behavior and even encourages it. And that's evidenced by Keith Davis Jr. That's evidenced by Larry Lomax. That's evidenced by Freddie Gray. And this is evidenced by Tyrone West, right? Many of the officers who beat Tyrone to death have been promoted. So these aren't isolated incidents in a vacuum. This is a culture that has been cultivated for centuries. And the fact, you know, none of us should be surprised at this point. Nobody should be surprised when this happens. And so when Catherine Philippou, the only reason that she left the department is because she got federally investigated by the FBI. So
I guess I'm glad that's enough to get them off the force.
And even that is
barely.
Support for this show is brought to you by the new Audible original Heads Will Roll from Saturday Night Live's Kate McKinnon and co-creator Emily Lynn. I am so excited about this Audible original. It's like TV for your ears. But just a heads up, before I tell you what the show's about, the content's not for kids. It is for mature audiences only, people like me and probably most of our listeners. There's some sexual content, adult language, and maybe some violence against hobgoblins. So, you know, use your discretion. Having said that, we're going to love it because here's what it's about. Enter the Night Realm, where the evil queen, Mortuana, and her ditzy raven sidekick have to put down a peasant rebellion to save the throne. So, will their friendship survive sensitive generals, chatty sex slaves, whiny behemoths, princes with bird fetishes, and, well, the notion of democracy itself? This audio satire also features the wicked talents of Meryl Streep, Tim Gunn, Peter Dinklage, Queer Eye's Fab Five, 80 Bryant, and so many more. Don't miss this hilarious scripted audio comedy bringing to you some of the greatest comedic talents in the industry. And you can check out this awesome new show for absolutely free, because you can start listening today with a 30-day Audible trial. All you have to do is visit audible.com/undisclosedheads. Yep, just like the show, Heads Will Roll, Undisclosed Heads. Or you can text Undisclosed Heads to 500-500. That's 500-500. Once again, start listening totally for free for a 30-day trial for audible.com. All you have to do is visit audible.com/undisclosedheads or text the word Undisclosed Heads to 500-500.
This is 2015 too. Like, I think there's been, over the last couple of years, there's been this sort of semi-reckoning in the department because of the Gun Trace Task Force indictments and the trials there and the kind of continuing investigation by the FBI. But I think what people need to remember contextually is that, you know, the officers in the Gun Trace Task Force, which was a specialized unit that was basically initially sort of tasked with tracing where all the illegal guns kind of how they end up in different people's hands, like who had them, kind of tracking all their attachments to various crimes. Then it became an enforcement unit. And that's when the officers in that unit were kind of altogether rampantly robbing citizens, framing citizens. There are a couple accounts involving the deaths of citizens, selling drugs, seizing drugs and then selling them, stealing money. But these were all officers who were doing this for the past over a decade. It's only after Freddie Gray, you know, and as the Department of Justice is coming in, you know, to implement the consent decree, that these officers ramped up their behavior. And that's exactly the culture in which not only were they ramping up their behavior, but these four shooting officers were unloading bullets into a garage and feeling fairly invincible about it.
And it's being proven that they are.
Yeah.
Right? So we have to make sure that we remember that, right? There have been zero consequences for these officers. Philippou, there's only been a consequence because she was a drug dealer caught on a FBI tab, right? Nothing has happened to these officers who shot at Keith and who shot Keith. And
well, why that undermined the prosecution if it did.
Why?
So yeah, why would they do that?
Exactly. Right. And so here we are. And this is the reality. This is the reality of this department, is that this has been going on for a very, very, very long time. And to think that this is new, we're lying to ourselves.
Now, you mentioned one of the witnessing officers, but were the others ever asked or ever given an explanation of why they didn't fire?
A couple of them, kind of. You know, like, I think that they're sort of, their answer would have been was sort of implied. So, like, the detectives, first of all, are not good and not smart at all. I mean, it's really kind of concerning. So, like, some of the officers, like Dean McFadden, for example, was behind Santiago and behind the kind of wall. So he wouldn't have been able to sort of fire. But some of them, you know, like, I'm curious why Thomas Kirby never fired. I don't think he was ever asked. He would have had, you know, he's one of the officers who repeatedly says that he sees Keith pointing the gun over the top of the refrigerator, but he never fires. And no, they never ask him. And, you know, there are a lot of things that go unasked. Like, it's one thing, I think that with witnessing officers, they can be interviewed, but they're not supposed to be interrogated. But that doesn't mean you can't ask follow-up questions. Like, you know, your job as an investigator is to figure out the truth. And there are ways of questioning people without making them feel like they're under investigation personally. But, you know, your job is not to just like ask a list of questions and then like take the answers and not even consider whether or not how they go together, you know? And that just did not happen at all.
It's like a bureaucrat's approach.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like a checklist, like a to-do list. And once you've checked off all the boxes, you're like, well, I did everything that I did everything that I was supposed to do.
Good enough for government work.
Right.
I mean, so, there are pictures in the crime lab photos of like the lead investigator down at the crime scene, Michael Boyd, who was also one of the lead investigators in the Freddie Gray investigation, that use of force investigation. Like there are pictures of him in the crime scene, like, you know, sitting, like just sitting. And not doing anything. Like, I, there are no photos that show him in any sort of way seeming to do any sort of investigating. And it's interesting because when he ends up being one of the people who testifies at a couple of the trials. And when he's asked about his role, even he's like, kind of like, oh, I didn't have much to do. It's utterly bizarre, the whole thing. There's a complete lack of self-awareness in a way of how lazy they are, honestly.
So in the episode, you discuss why it's obviously an issue if Eskins is out talking to witnesses like Mr. Holden.
Yeah.
What do we know about the communications between the involved officers or even the involved ones and the witnesses?
Well, the rule is that, you know, they're supposed to all be separated, so they can't talk about the incident. And involved officers and specifically are really, really not supposed to be talking to each other, talking to anybody else, doing anything. But that's true also of the witnessing officers. Like they all kind of need to just sort of be corralled off, separate from each other, brought down to homicide separately to give statements. That did not happen. They were all remained at the scene. It's not clear I don't think they were separated there. I mean, there's only so many places to go on that little block. And they were all transported down to homicide together, the witnessing officers. So that's a problem. The other thing I'll say is that, you know, there's been some photos. A guy named Joe Giordano, who's a photographer down in Baltimore, he was down there at the shooting scene, actually, and he took a bunch of photos for the city paper. And one of the photos that I came across in one of his articles is, it's a picture of the Northwestern District Major, Mark Partee, who came in to sort of came to the incident. And he's sitting there having like a little powwow, like a little tete-a-tete with at least one, if not, I think, three of the witnessing officers sitting in the back of Santiago's vehicle, like on the back bumper. Which, by the way, that car is part of the crime scene, to be very clear, because there is a shell casing inside of it. And they're just hanging out there chatting. And I look at that and I'm like, what's happening here? Like, what is, I wish I was a fly, like buzzing around that conversation. Because I honestly do wonder, because between all of their accounts, those witnessing officers, they have certain things, sort of interesting things that line up. And I very much wonder if there was a certain level of coaching.
But they did it, that coaching was, they did a terrible job, because then when they get on the stand, these officers, it's almost as if they're, you know, it's a Spider-Man pointing at each other about who cuffed Keith. They all said it was a different person. So they can't even get their shit straight when they're trying to lie.
I mean, that could honestly be they're the only one of them's lying. And the rest are in
no,
the fog of
all
war,
saying,
so to speak.
They're all saying different people.
Yeah, and they were
different
doing
people
that afterwards, too.
So it's not just they're saying the same wrong person picked Keith. They're all essentially saying, if they all stood in a circle, the person to their right cuffed Keith. So
they change their minds too sometimes. Like Eskins at one point at one of the trials said that he cuffed Keith, and then the next trial he was like, I didn't do it, it was somebody else. And it's like, it's constantly sort of changing.
I'm actually willing to, like, I think that's fairly understandable that in that situation, those not involved in the cuffing might see it in the corner of their eye and know someone did it and not have a clear distinct memory of who it was specifically, because that wouldn't necessarily have like an emotional trigger for them. But yeah, the dude who recalls that he did do it and then recalls he didn't, that's harder
right.
to explain.
Or like Diana Brown, you know, she's sure that her and Burns went in to cuff Keith because it takes two of them. And Burns is like, Burns has no idea who cuffed Keith.
Right.
And Burns even Brown even remembers, she has this whole sort of thing about how Burns had his cuffs out and she couldn't remember whether she took his cuffs or she used her own. And she has this sort of long memory. But Burns has zero of that. And this is 5 hours after. And then there's multiple other people who, two of the involved officers, both Eskins and Santiago, later go on to say that they both cuffed Keith. And it's like, by the time you sort of get to the end of it, you're like, did Keith have like three or four pairs of cuffs on?
Did he cuff himself?
Yeah.
I don't know. Can't rule it out.
Yeah, you never know.
Right. I mean, he had enough energy to take his wallet out and put the gun on top of a fridge as he's lying bleeding and unconscious.
They're never going to find it there.
Oh, right. I mean, it's madness. The narrative that they've put out that people buy, it doesn't make any sense. Like, if you line up the entire story from beginning to end that the state is trying to have people believe, it just defies logic. And what the state has been masterful at is really picking apart different pieces of the puzzle and then showing it to the jury and to the public in isolation without putting the puzzle together. And if the puzzle's put together, you look and say, this makes zero sense. These lies are allowed to, or, you know, generously mistakes, are allowed to continue to live because they're scattered all over the place and there's been confusion. And it's just so preposterous when you put it all together that it's just illogical. But they've been getting away with it. We're going to be on the fourth trial for this murder, and they're still contradicting each other on the stand, and nothing's being done about it. The judges let it happen.
Now, with regard to that phone, do we know for sure it cut off when Keith dropped it or was shot? Is it possible an officer clicked it off?
You know, it's possible, like, because I think that
I drop phones all the time, like, right. call, and they don't turn themselves off.
Nope.
Right. Well, and there's some other stuff coming up with the phone that's really kind of fascinating. But I think there's a lot of questions about the shot to the face. And how exactly that happened. Like, I think it's interesting, you know, the way that the garage is set up is that the refrigerator that Keith was taking cover behind is all the way to the back of the garage, but somewhat off to the left. And it's behind like a bunch of toolboxes and a big beam, like a metal beam. And so it's really shielded, actually. And in the dark garage, it would be hard to see. But the fact of the matter is it's sort of off to the left. And therefore, you know, the part of Keith's body that would be most likely to be struck would be the left side of his body, not the right. And all of his injuries are to the right side of his body, all the gunshots. And
could it be ricochets?
Maybe. I have questions about it. I think this is one of those situations where, like, there was no investigation into the ballistics at all, considering Keith's wounds, considering where the bullet holes are in the garage, and what does that sort of indicate, if anything. And maybe some things doesn't indicate anything they can really sort of suss out, or maybe there's some real big things that could have been figured out. There was, when I say zero of that. So we don't know. And, you know, what we're able to sort of figure out is, like, we can go by what Keith is able to remember, and he's able to remember certain things, and other things, you know, it's still sort of patchy for him. And then we can go by the officers.
He was not in a great place to be a witness for much of it at all.
Right, exactly. I mean, he can tell you, he remembers, you know, being dragged after he was shot, dragged a little bit. He remembers somebody going through his pockets. But by the time the medic arrived, I think he had really kind of passed out, or was, like, in such a fog state where he doesn't remember seeing the medic at all. And then he woke up in the hospital, and that's that. So we're sort of left with the information we have. And, like, what's been interesting looking through the crime scene photos is I think there's so much there even that can be really questioned and compared to the statements that come from the officers. And I think to myself, my God, what if somebody who was actually an investigator did this, like, at the time? What could we have learned then? And it's just disgusting that wasn't done. It, like, and this was what their job was. These were the use of force investigators. They were not there to investigate Keith, any involvement in some armed robbery. That was absolutely 100% not their job. And they kept that investigation, didn't give it to a robbery detective like they should have. They kept it for themselves and then basically used that as a cover for not doing a use of force investigation. And that's really honestly what happened.
And I wonder if that was sort of a direction that came from higher up, right? So, you know, again, we've talked about the context of the city at that time. It was this, first of all, the city was fatigued, right? There were so many people out and demanding justice. And I think state's attorney and the police capitalized on that. But if it had not been squashed, there would have been another uprising, no doubt. And so they were freaking the fuck out, I'm sure of it, when they realized that there were no cartridges in that garage from the gun. They knew immediately that gun hadn't been fired.
Right.
And so they
just
were
touch it and know.
You could just, you could just look at it. And it immediately was damage control.
Right.
And so they threw all the rules out the window. Not that they, you know, whether or not they always followed the rules before this is irrelevant to this argument. But, you know, they had to nip this in the bud immediately. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why, you know, Larry last week and said a couple times that, you know, they wanted Keith to die. And it would have been much, much, much easier if he did for them. And so, you know, they were sort of waiting it out. And meanwhile, you know, just on the just in case, they were trying to just piece all this stuff together and put out lies and put out all this misinformation in the media to get people to believe that what they did was justified. And it continued when when his surgery was blocked so many times to get that bullet out of his neck. That bullet was lodged in his neck for 2 years. He was getting literally, like, poisoned by this bullet that was moving closer to his spinal cord. And his surgery was blocked. And we had to do massive calls to get to the correctional facility, to his doctor, to all of us, to get that bullet out. And so it's been this ongoing thing of just trying to get Keith quiet and trying to get Kelly quiet. That's not working.
Yeah.
And so they're just going to keep ramping this up until they think they can win and get Keith in a cage for the rest of his life.
Or just keep having hung juries until the end of time.
Or keep having hung juries until the end of time, right? And so, you know, it's monstrous. It's really disgusting what is being done. And it's something that it's really hard for people to wrap their heads around of how unjust this actually is. It's so mind-boggling that it's really hard. It's a hard pill to swallow for people to think that these systems that have been in place and these organizations that are supposed to be protecting and serving us are not. And, you know, once you sort of allow your brain to start accepting that these contradictions exist, your understanding of reality begins to shatter, because you're like, oh my God, they're lying. They're just, you know, police don't always tell the truth. That badge doesn't inject truth serum into the people who wear it. People who are prosecutors aren't necessarily out for the good. And it just defies what we understood reality to be. And it's very, very, that's hard to wrap your head around. And I think that that's what has delayed Keith's support from growing and growing, is that you really have to accept that the world is not what you thought it was. And it's hard. It's hard.
Without the gun task force getting caught when they did, it's easy to see him getting no traction very limited traction.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right.
Because who would ever think the police would plant a gun at a crime scene? That's conspiracy theory talk right there.
Absolutely. Right. And exactly. they even admit it, right? The gun trace task force, they'll even admit that they're planting the guns. And then there's still people that are like, no, police would never do that. And it's like, oh my God.
Only the ones who admit it would do it. All the ones who say they don't do it, don't do it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. When you think about it, what happened in that garage was just the beginning of what has been so horrific. Like, this is just the start. This is the shooting. Like, we haven't gotten to the fact that, you know, Keith was not given access to proper medical care for years. That, you know, we haven't talked today about, like, the fact the discharge of a firearm charge. I mean, they knew the day of that he never fired a gun. Or we haven't gotten to the God. Snitch.
I want to get to that part.
Oh, my
part.
God.
I mean, so that part's not even, like, unique to Keith's case. It's like, it's a pretty, like, it could apply to any case. And it does apply to so many cases in Baltimore. But it's a very clear example of how these informants work and how just ad hoc it is when they put it together.
Seriously. It's like, really? You got a jailhouse snitch? Come on.
Like, and then, you know, some boss is like, wait, you got a jailhouse snitch and you didn't, like, at least change the paperwork to vouch for it.
Right. You didn't make sure that they were actually in the same tier. Like, come on.
But here's the thing. It worked initially.
Yeah.
It worked, right? So we can sit back and be like, I can't believe this happened. But it worked. And only until it was really uncovered of what a shitty job the state's attorney's office did with vetting him, but also, like, not telling the defense who this new witness was until, you know, that day, essentially, the day of the trial, that, you know, it initially worked. And we have to remember that, right? We have
and most
to remember
cases
that
when you don't have adequate defense counsel, it does work. It can work.
Yeah.
Plenty of cases where they've gotten away with it.
Right. So. And that's the reality that we have to remind ourselves, but it's almost like, well, never mind. It's cognitive dissonance. We're protecting our brains from really seeing the world for what it is. And that's been like, you know, jailhouse snitches who burn bodies in the trunks of their cars in Texas somehow end up magically getting Keith to confess to them in a place that Keith couldn't even get to. But people bought it.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
Well, unfortunately, I forgot to leave us time for listener questions. So we'll have to save those for next week. But any final thoughts, episode 3?
No, I think that's it. Okay. Next week is going to be exciting and interesting. And it's just getting started. The fuckery. Yeah.
One thing I would like to end on for my part is that you have to allow your brain to see these things as facts, because they are. And the fuckery is so massive that it's preposterous, and you almost are like, that's not, come on, what? But it's true, because there's evidence that's indisputable. So you just have to be ready to accept things that are painful to accept. And that there's an innocent man sitting in a cage right now for something he didn't do. And there's a person who killed somebody who was on their way to work, who knows where they are. So, you know, we need justice for Keith. Kevin Jones needs justice, because who knows who killed him and where they are.
Yeah. The reason why I wanted to do this podcast is I really wanted to put in people's faces all of it from start to finish, because I think hearing it, people found it sort of unbelievable. And I really wanted to do this and show it from start to finish so people would see, oh my God, you were like not lying. And actually just showing all the state's evidence and how ridiculous it is, and showing the officer's account so people would have to sort of look at it and say, oh my God, you are right. This is incredible. And this is so wrong. And we have to say something. We have to do what we can to stop it. So feel free to call Marilyn Mosby's office if you want to. Let her know how you feel.
Yeah, just, you know, call her, chat, and let her know your thoughts.
She loves
Send her a link to the podcast.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much, guys, for being here. And we'll be back next week with episode 4.
Thanks so much for listening to this special addendum episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, and Mital Talhan, our executive producer. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @UndisclosedPod.